Welcome back to the Hoops Temple podcast. We have a very meandering talk through the NBA, what we've seen, what we've liked, what some of the numbers are saying. You know, we hope you enjoy the show. Please stick around for the interview at the end with Dan Favaldi of the Hardwood Knox podcast. It's a really great chat. We talk a lot about the Knicks. So, you know, if you want to hear about the NBA's most average team from an above average, possibly even great podcast host, stick around. I like Vu, but I'm going to say, after that Lakers-Bucks game, I'm not trading Westbrook for them, let alone giving them a pick.
That's so good. Oh my goodness, that's so good. That's rich.
Best Lakers game I've seen in like 3 years.
Yeah.
Since the bubble. Completely unsustainable. The big three had zero turnovers. AD looked like a monster. Westbrook had 5 assists in his first 7 possessions on offense, just attacking out of the pick and roll and only looking to pass. And then like that sixth possession, he's like, cool, I've set up AD multiple times. I got Winnie and Gabriel a bucket. Now let me jack this completely contested by Giannis deep three with like 14 seconds in the clock. And I was like, all right, you can have this one. You've just gotten us the last several baskets. Fine. If we're on a 5-to-1 ratio, 5 for us, 1 for you, we'll take it, Westbrook. We'll do it. That's fine.
Westbrook has, and the Lakers conundrum has led to the sacrificing of Matt Ryan at the altar of championship pursuit. I'm curious to see if the moves come quickly. I think there's some sort of December 15th deadline. Do you guys know anything about that? Because I meant to check and then I didn't.
Yes. Players signed in the offseason can't be moved until the later of 30 days after they signed or December 15th.
Makes sense.
Now, the worrisome aspect is there's been a lot of rumors the Lakers are going to go sign Miles Bridges.
Mm.
Oh, yeah. What a hateable team. That'd be super, super fun shit, dude.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can't imagine LeBron greenlights that. I feel like that's part of his image is that he wouldn't associate himself with that.
You know, you'd hope that, but LeBron tweeted out, "Welcome to Cleveland" to Deshaun Watson, and he's friends with the home wrecker, Chris Paul. I'm just saying, I don't want to go too far down this rabbit hole because it's dark, but the Lakers could be the most hateable team if they trade for Beasley, sign Miles Bridges. LeBron will always have his lovers, but an equal amount of haters. Gentlemen, do we have a lighter topic? How about the Beam team taking down the Clippers? How are we feeling, guys?
They didn't stand a chance. I mean, I felt bad because there's no Paul George and no Kawhi Leonard.
That 14-point second quarter was... You felt a bit of pity on us for that?
Yeah. It was a rough one. I was really happy on the Kings side with Sabonis because he has struggled against... like the Steven Adams type. And I just figured Zubac would kind of give him trouble. Essentially anyone that's tall that he can't just kind of bully into the paint, but he handled them. He was the best player on the court yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard for the Clippers at the moment. Obviously missing those two guys that they are missing. It really just comes down to whether or not Marcus Morris and Reggie Jackson are both going to hit shots. And in that game, they both missed everything. So the Clippers just really struggle for any sort of offense.
What's your panic rating on the Kawhi, Paul George? How many games are they going to play together the next 5 years?
Maybe like 5. Kawhi seems more concerning. The general sort of feeling with George that I've seen is that like he is more so just like taking it easy. Or that, you know, he's deliberately not rushing back until he's 100%. Which is what Kawhi has done also. And they are questionable for the next game, so they should be returning sometime soon. But, you know, we're what, like a quarter of the way into the season already? And those, you know, PG actually has had some decent games, but Kawhi's done really not a whole lot. And for a team where the aspiration is championship, for them to be in a position where they're a playing team, and you know, there's really been a stratification in terms of these sort of top five legit teams, and the Clippers are not in that conversation, or not even in that next tier of conversation. So the panic meter is rising. Part of you as a Clippers fan wants to say, okay, well, these guys are going to take it easy. It's about the playoffs. You know, they'll come back and they'll be themselves. But the more games that they continue to miss, it's just like, even if they can come back, you know, what level are they going to be playing at?
With the Kings and their playoff chances heading into the season, I think they're better than we had anticipated, especially you guys had anticipated. But
definitely.
But I knew that to make the playoffs, even make the play-in, there was going to be some teams that had to kind of drop out of the contention, the Western Conference. The Clippers seemingly are one of them, but not to move on so fast, we can stay on the Clippers, but the Timberwolves look like that other team. We kind of penciled them in for 50 wins. I don't think they're going to get close to that.
I actually watched the Timberwolves win this week. I watched them play the Grizzlies, and it was one of the weirdest games because I had to go to the box scores afterwards and just verify the eye test. The Wolves got just pounded on the glass. The Wolves won the game, but they lost the rebound advantage 59-29.
Whew. My God, they're playing two centers, aren't they?
Well, Cat is out right now, and Gobert got in foul trouble early.
Was that the last? Okay, so Cat hadn't played in that game. Okay.
Yes. And Gobert was in foul trouble early, and Memphis just got anything they wanted at the rim until the fourth quarter, where Gobert comes in and really does a great job saving the day. But that game was the version of Anthony Edwards that we all expected, that we overrated in our top 100 exercise before the year. He had a steal, a dunk, a block, and then a three. Like, I mean, he just was everywhere in that fourth quarter. And then when Gobert came back and they were able to play them some minutes together without Gobert worrying about fouling out, like, he was hitting Gobert with lobs. He's still terrible in the pick and roll, but with open space, you kind of see what he's saying about how he doesn't want to play with other bigs, that they're just crowding things. And that's true. But if he can learn to play with them, they could absolutely be the dynamic team that we thought they could be. I guess it's not as clean of a fit as we thought it was going to be coming into the year, but I'm not selling my Wolves playoff stock yet.
There are two things that can happen here that I'm super interested to see. Either there's option A, which is the Timberwolves just aren't as good because Cat is arguably their best player and he isn't there. But the more interesting one, the more fun one, is they're better. Is they're better without him? And I think they have the recipe to actually make that happen, which is kind of both. It would be fun for the Timberwolves because you win games. Also, very frightening for the Timberwolves because that's not the point of this. And the core isn't together, and you gave up so much to have this core, and for it to work better without him would have pretty huge ramifications.
I think it'll work better without him because you have a much clearer pecking order. You don't have two guys fighting over the offense. This is now Anthony Edwards' offense. But I think that's a short-term win. And in order for them to hit championship contender status, you need it to be both their offenses. You need both those guys to play well. And so I think that's just going to take more time to mesh. And so it wouldn't surprise me if they rattle off some wins and actually look good. And you have people saying, well, should we trade Cat at the deadline? Should the Wolves trade? No, don't trade Cat. Figure it out. The idea of him as a pick and pop big next to Rudy as a pick and roll big, his complete defensive limitations versus Rudy's excellent defense. You know, there's still the potential there. They just haven't had enough time together. And I think this will be a shorter, easier way to get good fast, but it's got a much lower ceiling.
I kind of wish that the Wolves went in a slightly different direction, where I think that a lot of their issues have to do with a lack of shooting on the wing, I guess. So where we've seen Gobert really succeed is as the role man in a spread pick and roll in a wide open floor where you've got a dynamic ball handler like Anthony Edwards and Gobert with an open lane. But like a lot of these guys that just aren't going to create that spacing. And so I think that fans and probably even Anthony Edwards too have assigned a lot of their offensive issues to Gobert, which probably part of it is true. But also the fact that they are so lacking in shooting throughout the rest of the roster. I think is a big, you know, hindrance to Anthony Edwards and also to Gobert. If they just had a four that could shoot, like if Kyle Anderson was a shooter.
Isn't that what Cat is? Cat is supposedly the best shooting, whatever, big man, center, forward, person in from American history.
That's a great point, Dylan. The Timberwolves are making the seventh least amount of threes and are shooting 32% from deep, which is the third worst. Just a quick question, because this has changed. Which team makes the least amount of threes per game in the league?
The Lakers.
It's not the Lakers anymore. It's a team that maybe I don't watch enough basketball, but it's kind of surprising. It's Atlanta.
Mm.
They make 9.5, which is dead last. It's 0.1 behind the Lakers. And they're shooting the fourth worst percentage. The Knicks are shooting the worst percentage from deep, 31.9%.
That's not surprising.
The Hawks are taking the second least threes. It feels different from the Hawks team we've seen from in the playoffs last year.
Well, you got to kind of ask yourself, who are their 3-point shooters? And, you know, DeAndre Hunter will shoot threes. John Collins will shoot threes, but neither is really a dead-eye shooter. Trey has been in a slump all year. He's shooting 30% on his own, which that's going to drag you down. Justin Holiday is shooting 8.1 threes per game.
Oh, my God. we're in a dark place in Atlanta.
Bogdan's been out. But yeah, he's only played the one game. So, you know, they've got some shooting resources to come back. But I meant to actually start off by bringing up Trey much earlier today. Trey had some words with his coach, Nate McMillan, and then missed a game. And a lot of this is breaking like the couple of minutes before we started recording this. So I'm sure by the time this is all out, you know, edited, whatnot, shout out to our producer, Jacob, for trying to make sense of this mismatch. Go give him a follow. I'm sure we'll have more information and once that's done. But I think that's could be really pivotal. Well, if he drives another coach out or if there's another falling out with the coach, because I don't know how many coaches Atlanta will go through.
They said, at least Trae Young said, or someone around Trae Young said, that it was just a miscommunication on why he missed that game, which is NBA slang for I fucking hate my coach and I hope he gets fired. So I'm curious to see how long that hangs on for.
It's interesting that we moved from Atlanta's lack of 3-point shooting efficiency, but also attempts, into Nate McMillan, who's historically been a very mid-range happy coach. And he's now got DeJounte Murray, who's one of the most, I guess, prominent mid-range shooting guards in the league. And you wonder the correlation between those two. And maybe to Trey's point, whether a coach who has more of an emphasis on shooting threes may help to improve Atlanta's offense. That's one of the places that, you know, we're talking about our preseason predictions and top 100s and so on. One of the places where I was really wrong with Atlanta is you'll remember that I had them ranked as one of the best offenses in the league, which was leading me to way overrate their win prediction. And the thing that I didn't factor in is the loss of 3-point shooting from guys like Gallinari and Bogdanovic, who's been injured for a lot of this year.
And Kevin Huerter. Kevin fucking Huerter. He's on fire.
And of course, losing probably their best shooter to the Sacramento Kings and Kevin Huerter.
Huerter is shooting, I think, close to 80% on threes assisted by Domantas Sabonis.
I thought you were going to say overall, and I didn't doubt you.
I think he's close to about 50% right now. John Collins is doing a very strange PJ Tucker impression this season. I just don't feel like his usage is... He's not being used correctly. He was very effective a few years ago. I'm not really sure what the change has been. He kind of sits in the corner.
Yeah, I'll admit, I haven't watched the Hawks much recently. There have been too many other good games and good players making their mark. Zion has been fantastic. I watched that Tatum-Celtics Heat game, where he dropped 47. watch the Booker 50-point explosion. I missed his two 40-point explosions. Still need to go back and catch up on those. Guys, that era, that generation is here.
Me and Nate had texted a bit about the top 100 we had made. Actually, we had talked earlier this week about it. And with Booker, he's here. And I think originally when I made the top 100, I kind of projected him to take a leap close to the top 10. I think about 11, and Nate talked me down. But I think we're back to that, like close to a fringe top 10 player, because I don't think Jimmy Butler's in that conversation. I especially don't think Kawhi's in that conversation. And that leaves some spots open.
And we've always known that Booker can score. But the thing that I really loved about watching him play that Chicago game was he didn't start off scoring. He started off passing. He got Ayton involved and set up, and then he started attacking the basket. So first he gets the passing game going. Then he gets the attacking the basket, the drive, the mid-range going. And then he starts shooting threes. And he ends the game 20 for 25. 51 points, sits the entire third. It was masterful. And like his passing has become really good. And his defense allows for some different things. It allows him to match up against the team's best player, which if he's a bad defender and he has to match up against the team's best offensive player, or sorry, their worst offensive player, then he's matching up against a Caruso. He's matching up against a Patrick Williams. He's matching up against the guy that's going to defend him on the other end. But when he's playing good defense and he's matching up against a Rosen, then you get these cross matches where they're scrambling to try to get the right defender to him, and he's able to take advantage of that on the offensive end. The defense unlocks easy offense for him. And then when they did get the right matchups, he was quicker than Patrick Williams and made him look embarrassed to be on the NBA court. And he bullied my guy, Alex Caruso, which just makes me sad to see Caruso not stopping him. But Booker has stepped it up a level. I will say, I watched the Celtics Heat game right after the Suns game. After watching what Booker did, the Tatum 47 points was so much less impressive.
It was a stupid, lame, unimpressive 47 points. No one cares. Anyone can get it. I mean, Boston only has like the best narrating in the league by such an insanely massive margin. And it's just they have an offense rating of 121.
I should say the Boston offense was beautiful. It was clicking. It was moving. They made a concerted effort to touch the paint and then kick out. My lack of amazement in Tatum's game is probably a amazement more so in the offense, which was a five-person dance. You know, guys would cut into the lane, receive the pass, and then redirect it without ever even looking at the basket. And so, like, Tatum was the recipient of a lot of those plays where it's just the offense humming. Whereas Booker was everything. He was consistently involved, and it was his drive or his pass or something that would unlock it for the other guys. Not quite heliocentric, but much more Booker focused.
It's been, to your point on the beautiful flow of the offense, I think one thing that's been quite impressive with the Celtics is their ability to find really good coaches, like Ime Udoka last year. Was their, you know, sort of chosen guy after Steven stepped down, and then they have to go on to the next coach and pick Joe Mazzulla, who no one had ever heard of. And he's looking like is he maybe a coach of the year already?
So frustrating as a Kings fan. You just get to like have one coach disappear, and then then I can have to find the next guy who can run the best offense in NBA history. It's fine. Don't worry about it. You just get the next one, and he's just a genius. Although, you know, Mike Brown has been
awesome. They had Ime Udoka last year, who led them to like one of the best defenses of all time, and then they bring in Joe Mazzulla this year, and they're just the best offense of all time.
Well, I think we need to remember, 3 years ago, they had Brad Stevens, who was no slouch of a coach. You know, we all love Brad Stevens.
Probably top five coach.
I mean, like, there were some questions there at the end. People weren't always the most amazed by him near the end, and he needed a break. They needed a fresh voice. But then they bring in an Ime, and then they don't get their like first choice because Will Hardy leaves before the Ime stuff falls apart. So this is in theory coach number four, because Will Hardy also started off the year are just fantastic.
Yeah, Will Hardy's awesome too. It's just I'm just I don't know. What's the Luke Walton coaching tree looking like? Is there anything coming of that?
He's in Cleveland right now.
Mm.
He's what?
He's in Cleveland.
Don't.
He's, yeah, assistant coaching on the Cavs, helping them with their great offense.
Yeah. Listen, I think, Aaron, it's okay. It's okay. You can let it out. But I think you got to realize it's ownership and it's the front office. This wasn't Luke Walton's fault.
It's getting better. Right? I think we're going to extend Monte McNair soon. We're going to have a general manager for more than one contract, which is cool. We're going to have a coach for a few years, hopefully. Maybe win like 41 games. I'm super stoked. You know, Al Horford has 135.5 offensive rating this season. Just throwing that one out there. I don't know what the record is, but that seems pretty good.
I mean, they just gave him a 2-year extension that'll last until he's 39, which in theory, I keep hearing people talk about what the cap spike might look like because they are expecting another cap spike in a year or two.
2025, new TV deal.
2025.
Yeah.
Hopefully by then we'll all have the chip that, you know, we can just watch games in our head and not need a TV.
Horford has had such a strange career. His longevity is so good, but he also just essentially took like a season and a half off and just stopped playing basketball and then came back and he was better than he was before. I think that should be the new strategy for veterans. If you trade for a veteran, you just say like, hey, like, go home for a year. Come back better, please.
I mean, I don't know how we didn't learn this. Michael Jordan did it and it worked really well. So
that's true. Is it the Al Horford strategy or the Michael Jordan strategy, though? Because I feel like equal importance.
Yeah. I feel like part of Horford's improvement also is like the league catching up to him. Yeah. Or like his style of play. You know, like early on in Atlanta, he was like a pretty good offensive player, pretty good defensive player, but he was undersized. He had certain flaws that way. You know, he could shoot, but not super efficiently. So didn't take a high volume. But now, like, good defensive 6'10 is, you know, that's big. And being able to defend and shoot passably and, you know, be smart is like the ideal center now. And so I feel like part of it is that he did get better, but also that the league sort of formed itself in a way where his skill set that he's always kind of had has now become, you know, sort of the ideal big man.
That's a great point. It's the anti Andre Drummond and DeAndre Jordan, where they just had the rug pulled out from under them. Like, oh my God, we're not good anymore. Al Horford woke up one day. He's like, I am better than I was before. The league loves me.
I always kind of wonder when the league makes those shifts, do the guys that shift would ideally help actually get better, or do they get worse? Because we can look at like the three-point shooting barrage, and like a lot of people who were good three-point shooters prior to that don't get this bump. A lot of them kind of fall off because now it's like, oh, the thing that we were really good at, this thing that we specialized in, now everyone can shoot 35% from three. Now me shooting 35 or 37% isn't special. So the fact that I can't play defense, pass, dribble, or anything else like looks really bad. But yeah. Horford, I guess there aren't enough multifaceted, talented big men to push Horford off his block.
But to your point on the way that these sort of specialists get eliminated when you think that they would be coming into greater importance, it's I wonder how much of that is with, you know, sort of each development. There's sort of two facets to it. And so more three-point shooting. Fantastic. I'm a spot-up shooter. I'm a really good shooter. I've just become more valuable. More three-point shooting means you have to defend three-point shooting. You've got to be able to get over screens. You've got to be able to move your feet quickly, stay in front of guys. And so, yes, that three-point shooter is now more valuable, but you've got to be able to defend three-pointers, which is really hard to do if you're, you know, a slow white guy that just comes off screens and spots up.
This is Steve Novak's obituary. You just read it. You just read it off. It's the death of Steve Novak's career. Poor guy.
Ugh. Poor Jason Capono. Shout out to Vladimir Radomanovich.
So many great careers.
You know, that also is a great point, though, because I was thinking of it as like specialists, but Horford is almost the anti-specialist. He is the player without weakness, even though he does not have the strength. Like, he doesn't I mean, yes, he is a good defender. Yes, he is a good big man passer. I should say, slight tangentially, the wildest thing that I heard while watching basketball was there's no greater big man passer than Steven Adams this week. That was a fun quote from the Memphis announcing broadcast. Not sure what, I'm not sure if they've ever seen Denver play, but yeah, Horford does everything above average. There's not like a weak point in his game. So he is the anti-specialist.
Are the Celtics the runaway favorite to win the title so far for you guys? I mean, they're clearly the best team in the league. Do you think this is sustainable? Do you also think no one will catch them?
Yeah, I mean, just the lack of another contender, I feel like makes them the easy favorite. Like, because we look at, let's just look at net rating like you were doing before. Boston way ahead of everyone, followed by Phoenix, who, I mean, you know, we've seen them have issues in the playoffs. Interestingly, they were similar to this last year, where they were the runaway favorite by, in terms of net rating. But I think that the Celtics now have a lot of playoff experience, even though they've got young guys. They've had guys with deep runs. And you go through the net rating, like New Orleans is third. Like, New Orleans have been awesome, but I don't think that they're a championship contender. You look at Cleveland, Dallas have their issues. Sacramento is right up there.
Gotta be respectful.
like, which of these teams is going to take Boston in a 7-game series? It's really hard to find that team.
Milwaukee. And maybe,
yeah, like the elephant in the room, the one that I skipped over,
found it.
Is Milwaukee. I mean, they're probably the second best team. But, you know, they have major offensive issues at times. And even in their championship season, they really won because the team that they were going up against really couldn't create good offense, and neither could they. Whereas the Celtics are the best offense of all time at the moment and do have really good defensive versatility to lock in when they need to. So it's sort of hard to really pick any team that's coming up.
So I've been listening to a lot of this podcast called The Hardwood Knox, but he was asked a question in the mailbag of, would you rather be a team that is experimenting throughout the course of the regular season and coming in with like the fourth seed, or be the team that just runs and clicks and has everything down and come away, you know, with the first seed? And he said experimenting, and he used the Bucks as the example. And I think that's right. I think, you know, Denver is really trying something right now. Jokic has not been shooting. Jokic has been super pass heavy, trying to get guys involved. And I think as long as Murray's still not there, it doesn't matter too much. But if Murray gets back, I mean, Aaron Gordon and Bruce Brown are quietly having fantastic seasons. I think Milwaukee has weathered the storm without Chris Middleton. He is now back. I also think they have a bullet in their chamber as far as a trade to make. They've got some future picks that they could potentially move. If they pulled off a Bojan Bogdanovic from Detroit, that's a name that's going to move somewhere. That's something that's going to happen. Yeah, I think I don't see Boston as the favorite. Well, ooh, maybe they are the favorite. Sorry, maybe they're the favorite, but I don't see them as overwhelming at this time. I see them as a team who has had their core together for an extensive period, hasn't had any notable injuries to key pieces, and is clicking. And that's kind of what we expected. And I do say all that recognizing that Robert Williams has been out. He was out before training camp. He is a core piece. He's an injury, but it's not like a Chris Paul will be an out. It's not Chris Middleton. It's not a Chris. It's a Robert. I know I've already picked on the Tatum game once, but I think it's the fourth most impressive game I watched this week by an individual.
Where does Domantas Sabonis's 10 of 11 shooting on Zubac rank? Is that around the 47 game from Tatum? Or,
you know, I didn't watch that one yet, so I can't rank it. But I'm going to take that one step further. It's the fifth most impressive game I watched this week by an individual.
The post hooks are sexy. I'll just throw it out there. They're a joy to watch.
Oh, I like a nice post hook.
We've talked so much about contenders, and we haven't mentioned at all the defending champion, the Warriors. They've had their struggle. I think the transition from the old core to the new core has proven to be rocky, especially given James Wiseman is just not an NBA player. So an interesting stat that really jumps out is the Warriors have the lowest free throw rate in the league, and also are just one of the worst teams, not the worst team in the league, when Steph isn't playing. Andrew Wiggins had a great game yesterday, but do you guys see that path for them where they're just back in the playoffs, a 3 seed, even a 4 seed, and are able to pull together some playoff series?
Isn't this kind of what happened last year with the Warriors? Like, no one really thought about them. They had an unimpressive regular season. You know, they weren't brought up as one of the teams that was likely to win the championship. And then all of a sudden, their guys are clicking. Steph Curry's, like, still absolutely, like, at his peak. You know, there's no step back from Steph Curry whatsoever. Their five-man starting lineup is still one of the best lineups in the NBA. And so, like, once you get to the playoffs and you don't have to play your bench guys as much, and you have to rely on, you know, cohesiveness and experience, you wonder whether the Warriors have a similar run to what they did last year.
The Warriors, I think you have it flipped just a little bit, because the Warriors had started 18. They started 18-2. They were just on fire. They lost a game in overtime by 3 and a game by 4 to Charlotte of all teams. But then towards the end, at one point they're 41-13, but they kind of, after that, they kind of limp to 53-29, a losing record in that stretch. But they had the time and the health was right when it mattered. But I guess the issue being is the health is there for the Warriors right now, and they just aren't that great.
Yeah, I think they're the opposite side of things, where they're experimenting. You know, they are trying to see what they can get out of the young guys. And Kerr recently said, hey, I'm going to pull the young guys out of the rotation as much. Get us some wins. Get us some breathing room where it's not life or death. And he did that. And then they're winning. And so I'm just quietly not worried about them. Golden State last year, by a quirk of the schedule and being the opening night game, was either the first or second seed in the West. Until, like, gosh, what is this, March? So that they were really good last year. And I think they can get back to that pretty quickly. They're definitely trying to focus on getting Clay going. And Clay offensively looks pretty good. He's moving well. The shots aren't always falling, but he has the movement and the spacing and the quick release that I'm used to seeing in him. Not there on defense. And their bench, they're experimenting. They're trying to figure it out.
And so based on that, Nate, do you think that the Warriors are the favorites in the West? Are they your favorites?
Well, I did pick against the Warriors getting out of the first round last season in our playoff bracket. And this is the third straight year that I'm going to pick the Denver Nuggets to beat the Warriors. Maybe it'll finally come true. But right now, I'm still seeing Milwaukee making it. And I think if not Golden State, then it's Denver in the West.
Moving on a little bit, Nate, your team, the Lakers.
Yeah.
Are they,
welcome back to title contention.
Are they the best team in the world? Welcome back to Undisputed. The Lakers are 8-2, or 8-2 in the last 10. They only had to play the worst teams in the league for half of those. Are they the best team in the West?
I mean, it's hard to argue with the results.
It was a very impressive Bucks win, but I think the key for this is Anthony Davis, and I love it. Like, as much as fun as it was to, like, bash on Davis, he's one of the greatest players ever. I figure we had him ranked in eight, like close to 60, right? Close to
50. We dropped him out of the Anthony Davis. No, he's like 12.
Sorry, no, the top 100 of all time.
Oh yeah.
Which is close to that. He's like one of the 60 best players ever. And I had said in the TikTok video a while ago, like, if things go right, you're looking at someone who probably can crack the top 30. And everyone kind of said that's not happening. And I kind of agreed with them, but we're back on that trajectory. This is as good as he's ever been. He's just as good as he was at his peak in 2020 or in New Orleans. This is such a good version of him dominating inside. Like, I really haven't seen. The rebounding numbers are just bonkers, and defensive metrics are insane.
No, that's expected. That is what the projection trail that we've had for Davis since he was a rookie told us he would be at this age. Like, this is the problem. And Davis in my all-time matrix, I had to tweak numbers and formulas because it had Davis as like the 30th best player at all time at one point. And I was like, that cannot be true. But the player, he is just amazing in player efficiency rating. He models as a guy that should be Tim Duncan or Hakeem Olajuwon, but with a little bit more range and ball handling in statistical models. And so we're finally getting that. We're finally seeing what he should be. And he just needs to stay healthy, which has always, always been the Achilles heel for him.
What is interesting about the Lakers' recent resurgence is that they're doing it really just with great offense. If you go back to the bubble title and some of those, that sort of team, it was based on really good defense and then LeBron and Davis being enough to get you to passable offense. But in the last 2 weeks, the Lakers are fifth in offense and 13th in defense. And so it's really the scoring which is elevating them. And if you look at the squad that Rob Pelinka sort of put together, like these Lonnie Walker and Thomas Bryant, some of these guys, like one-way offensive players, you wonder if that's sort of the path to success for the Lakers is like AD is enough to get us to average. AD and LeBron are enough to get us to average. Patrick Beverley will do some stuff, but maybe the key to success is leaning in offensively.
I still, hanging over all of this is, can you win a playoff series playing Russell Westbrook minutes?
Yeah, that's the question, is can he play like that? Which is really just, hey, we're cutting out the bullshit shots. I mean, he jacked up two threes. I hated both of them the minute he released them, and he missed them both. But he came in and he was a passer. He was a pass first player. He found Davis for three straight plays. Then he found Wendy and Gabriel. And I forget who the next play was too. I'm sure I have it in my notes. But that is what you need. And if he's out there being a pass first player, Austin Reeves is helping with the defense. One of Troy Brown, Lonnie Walker, or Wendy and Gabriel is good at the moment. You just need one of them to be there. And then Davis is at power forward and LeBron at center. I kind of like LeBron at center with Davis as power forward. I think that's what the lineups really lacked, was just a weak side rim protector if LeBron's going to be your center. And we had the best one available. So
can LeBron handle that physically, though?
Yes.
Maybe. I think he can do it, but you worry about...
Bring on Jokic.
You worry about the impact on his body. I'm not saying... I'm sure he probably honestly do a pretty good job defending Jokic, but I just don't think he already was hurt this season. I can't imagine that. I just feel like someone has to play center and someone's going to get hurt trying to do it.
I think it's a good move for LeBron, because I think LeBron is not as physically dominant, or sorry, he's not as athletically dominant. He's not as quick or as explosive as he once was. You've seen,
he is still physically dominant.
Yes, he still has the strength, and as the league has gotten quicker, his lack of speed is really apparent watching him try to guard guys on the arc. But if you take him in the post, this is fine. This is great. Or if your center is just going to be a spot-up shooter, like what Milwaukee tried to do half the game with Brook, cool. He just gets to stand and guards the guy that can't really cut.
Mm.
Great.
Yeah. And conversely, too, like if the idea is that LeBron's going to get stuck guarding the post, and that's a bad thing. Like, how many post-up centers are there in the NBA? Like, two?
And how many of them are that much stronger than LeBron? Like, LeBron is a tank.
Yeah, but has he played Zubac? Yeah. I don't think he had. Just throwing it out there, because he definitely had him. I don't know if he has.
Well, he never played him in practice. Otherwise, he wouldn't have traded him for Mike Muscala. God, that...
Yeah, the Lakers could use a guy getting 30 points, 30 rebounds.
My dad drafted Zubac, I don't know, in like the third round of our fantasy basketball league. And nice. It was really dumb at the time. And you're just like, what the hell is dad doing? And, you know, and it turns out, yep. you know, he's a genius. Yeah. He also took Ban. He also, I think the next round, he took Banchero. And I was like, that's also too high. And then they're both just really good.
Yeah.
He knew something I did.
You're saying we should have your dad on the podcast to tell us all how to play fantasy sports?
There you go. We should have the Justin Schroeder segment.
Well, can I tell you guys about the other game that I felt was more impressive than Jason Tatum?
I mean, there were five of them, so we need the full rundown.
So I think my ranking order goes that Devin Booker game that I watched, the 51-pointer. Then the AD's performance as the number two game. And then I do think Giannis is three. Giannis is either three or four. And then the number four game is Zion Williamson, the Pelicans Raptors, which may not have been his best game this week, even looking at his numbers. But he came in and just bulldozed Toronto. Like, they have this whole long switchable thing. No. Zion went straight to the basket. He went through whoever was guarding him, through switches. You know, they didn't have traditional rim protection. And Koloko came in, got like three or four blocks pretty effortlessly. But Zion just went through guys, got to the basket, was scoring at will, finished the game 12 for 15. So 80% from the floor, 9 for 7 from the line. And then the other really nice thing was that his passing, he threw this left-handed off the dribble, just bullet twice, back-to-back plays. One was to Jonas Valanciunas for a dunk, and the other was kick out. I think maybe Dyson Daniels for three. But that Zion is the scary Zion. That Zion is why I'm so glad I picked him in the greatest of all talks, Dynasty League, because that Zion is a future MVP. And a champion.
You have Zion in that fantasy league? I have Derrick Rose. Things are going poorly for me.
Why did you take Derrick? Listen, that league is going horribly for me as well. Half my team is injured. But
I think I took it with like my last pick. Because at that point it was just like bench guys. And I was like, well, Derrick Rose at least plays. So.
I've just been streaming Grizzlies. I have Desmond Bane, Santi Aldama, Conchar. And Brooks, just streaming them in and out of the lineup when I need someone, and because my next guy up is hurt. But let's do that exercise. You guys got to ask me, who are my title contenders right now? Who are your guys' title contenders right now? Because I'm feeling Nuggets or Warriors versus Bucks. Are you guys switching your picks? Dylan, do you have the spreadsheet up?
I don't even know if I saved it, to be honest.
Oh my gosh. That's a terrible guys, this is a terrible segment.
My title contender is the Celtics. I think they're a machine right now. And I'd much rather them keep up this pace and just roll people than what the Nuggets may be. I think the Nuggets ceiling is like the greatest offensive ever, but the Celtics are just already doing that. So.
Mm. And I think I'll go with who I'm pretty sure I had last time, Celtics and Warriors. Celtics look unbeatable. Warriors are figuring it out. They've got that championship, you know, cachet.
Do I need a Western Conference team? Are we doing two of them?
Yeah, we need the finals.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
You going to say it? You going to put your Kings in there?
Oh, man. The West kind of sucks. It's basically like Phoenix.
It does. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess it's, I'm going to say I'll play it safe in the early season to say and say Celtics and Phoenix.
I know.
Next week I'll take Sacramento, and I'll say that for the rest of the year.
You heard it here, folks. Aaron has just jinxed Sacramento.
Oh no.
Like I could do any more damage. It's a cursed franchise.
Hey, they're still currently winning the state of California. All right. Well, thank you guys for joining us.
I haven't seen the beam yet. I'm so disappointed.
I hope you guys enjoy this interview with Dan Favalli of the Hardwood Knox podcast. Also, like and subscribe here. Rate us in wherever you get your podcasts. Share us with a friend. Hit us up. hoopstemple@gmail.com or on Twitter or on TikTok. Aaron, what's your TikTok?
Possible Chips. You can also find me in the Valley View blacktop looking at the beam from an elementary school, or in my girlfriend's living room looking at the beam through a telescope.
Dylan, where can the people find you?
In your podcast feed, as long as you click the follow button.
All right, gentlemen. Welcome back to the Hoops Temple podcast. Y'all know me, Nathan Schwartz. Join me for the first time, Dan Favalli. Dan Favalli is joining us from Bleacher Report and the Hardwood Knicks podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. Would you describe yourself as a diehard Knicks fan or just a lifelong Knicks fan?
More like a deadly disenchanted Knicks fan. They can still hurt me, but I grew up a Knicks fan and I think they killed a lot of the soul and a lot of my lifeblood. But they can still hurt me on occasion, which is pretty impressive, because if you set the bar so low, you shouldn't be able to hurt that much, but there's a low bar and they continue to go under it.
The original co-host of the Hoops Temple pod, Richard, is from New York City and was a very similarly hurt Knicks fan.
Yeah, they're takes a special breed to consistently root for this team year in and year out. The nature of my job is I can't watch every Knicks game, and I think that's probably been better over the past decade for my mental health since I started covering the NBA.
Sure. Well, I asked our producer to try to find me a Knicks guy a little bit ago. When the Knicks were the most average team, they were, you know, 500. I think they were 16th in offensive rating, 16th in defensive rating. What do you just want to open up the floor? What are your general takes on the Knicks team? What's good? What's bad? What's working? What's not?
I think you summed it up nicely that they might be the most average team in the NBA. But just overall, the thing that I've been so critical of Tibbs for is that he's so rigid and stubborn with his rotations. He's been a little bit more experimental this year, but almost to the point that you don't understand what he's doing. He'll throw out Jericho Sims in like the fourth quarter randomly when all his other centers are available. And I do think there's an element of this team that's built to be that way, because they're deep with NBA players, not particularly above average NBA players, but they're deep with interesting young players. They're deep with veterans who can play. And so it makes for just this weird rotation. And, you know, there was a day where like Tibbs going nine deep was like shocking. And that definitely falls on the front office, where it's, you know, if you want Obi Toppin to play, Julius Randle shouldn't be on this team right now. And why did you sign Mitchell Robinson, Isaiah Hartenstein, and Jericho Sims over the offseason? Like, this team to me, more than anything, has been confusing. They've had some nice moments, including Julius Randle. RJ Barrett is like one of the NBA's most turbulent human roller coasters. Cam Reddish has given them some really nice defensive energy at points. I wish he would pass the ball more on offense. But you look at this team, and for a team that actually does have players that are worth watching and are good, they have not optimized it. This team is built to be like ninth. And that's not something you should build a team for when you're actively, aggressively trying to avoid a rebuild, which is what the Knicks have done. So he's been dealt a poor hand, but he's then played it even more poorly than it's set up to be played. And that's just my impressions of the Knicks so far. Again, there are bright spots, but when you look long term and hear things like, oh, they're shopping Emmanuel Quickley, who's been one of their better perimeter defenders this season, and both him and Obi Toppin are extension eligible, but it doesn't seem like they have like this place long term in the rotation. And they're stockpiling these draft picks to trade for a star, only to then not trade them for a star who wanted to come to New York when he was available. They're, the word to sum up the Knicks, aside from average, is just confusing. And maybe, like, if you wanted to go a step further, and I don't think this is unfair, aimless is just what they feel right now.
Well, good news. You've just gotten the call from James Dolan. You're now in charge of the Knicks. What's your first moves? How are we making? What are we consolidating?
I'm tearing the whole thing down. It's something I've wanted them to do forever, and they just don't want to rebuild organically. When they looked like they were doing it for a minute under Donnie Walsh, they pivoted to chasing free agents. It looked like they're doing it for a minute under Phil Jackson, then all of a sudden, like, Kristaps is on the trade block. Then it looks like they might be doing it for a minute with this regime. Oh, no, they're not. Like, they're always constantly chasing other teams' players. So if I actually were in charge and had the autonomy to do that, I'd strip it down. And I don't know, like, yeah, I'd want to keep Obi and Grimes and Quickley and see what the young guys would do. I would still argue that playing the youth more is actually a way for them to get better immediately. That's my firm belief. And so realistically, Julius Randle would be gone or not playing. If it costs a first round pick to get rid of him at this point, so be it. Evan Fournier, he hasn't played much either. Derrick Rose, like those are players I'd be shopping incredibly hard. Jalen Brunson, I think he streamlines a lot of development, so you can keep him. But like I'm testing out, what do I have in Reddish, who's going to be a restricted free agent this year? What do I have in Obi and Quickly, who are both going to be extension eligible this summer? What does it look like when Obi's your five? Like what, when we play five out and Hartenstein's not on the floor, I'm stripping the entire thing down, keeping as many young guys as possible. Is RJ untouchable? I'd like to see, he just signed an extension, so you can't, it's too hard to move him. So I'd probably just keep him, but that's what I would lean fully into what this team I think is needed. And that's a youth movement. That's also juxtaposed with an actual rebuild to where you're experimenting and you know that, hey, we're improving our own lottery odds. We're not just trying to trade these picks for other teams' players.
Does the Kristaps Porzingis memories make you at all hesitant about trying to tank out and go for Victor Wembanyama?
No, just because I think when you look back, Kristaps was just never the guy that you wanted to put the ball in the hands of, who could operate from the outside in. His best role has always been something that he's actually not the best at, which is he doesn't want to play off the ball a ton and pick and pop and stroke threes. He wants his touches in the post. He's done a little bit better of a job of that in Washington this year, but it's still just not, he can't be an offensive hub. And so the injury is definitely concerning, but the way that when you watch Victor Wembanyama, from what I'm seeing of him, there's a fluidity and feel that was never there with Kristaps. And I think Porzingis, like some other players, got the, oh, plays in a big market, they didn't suck, so they became overrated bump. But Victor Wembanyama to me just feels like a generational, transcendent, you know, once every decade or two player. And it's too late now. Just like, you're not like, there are other teams that are just so bad, you're not going to out tank them. I would have done everything in my power to take my ass off this season, especially when all these other teams that were supposed to tank, like the Pacers or the Jazz, started off the season so strong. It created sort of like this opening for other teams to be bad enough to enter those sweepstakes. But I absolutely positively would have tanked my butt off for, a, you know, I don't care if it's only a 14% chance at Victor Wembanyama. That's high enough for me to tank.
Well, and it really complicates things with their guards, because Grimes, Quickly, and Reddish, you can only play one of the three of them next to Brunson and RJ Barrett. Barrett doesn't have the size. Reddish doesn't really have the size to slide up to the four, at least in a Tibbs style team, and where he's not going to get too experimental. Maybe if he's got, you know, Will Hardy or someone that's going to try something a little bit more out
there.
RJ
would be playing the four in Utah. That's a great point. RJ would absolutely have played time at the four in Utah this season. That's a fantastic point.
And if RJ was playing the four, then we could actually have some more of these good experimental lineups out there.
Yeah, I mean, you're not wrong. I mean, the Knicks have like dabbled in it a little bit, but it's never been something that they've committed to. And I'm not saying RJ is a four, but like, hey, RJ, like play your best wing defenders, make it Quickly, Grimes, RJ, and Reddish. And
yeah.
Just see what happens. And if you're really that worried and you need the traditional rim protector, Mitchell Robinson can be your five, or Isaiah Hartenstein to give you the spacing. It doesn't have to be Obi. I would pay a lot of money to see that lineup with Obi, but you're absolutely right. Like, it doesn't have to be like this permanent staple, but fucking try it. Sorry. I don't know if you cuss on this podcast.
I do. Real ass word.
The Knicks just bring the F bombs out in me, because the lack of experimentation, which there's been more of this season, but the lack of consistent experimentation is pretty frustrating.
Well, I have two final Knicks questions, both trade related, before I want to move into some of your writing. But first, how much are you willing to attach Julius Randle to get him out of here?
Probably one first round pick that is not the Knicks' own is where I'm at. And I know some people will just be like, I'm not giving up any first round picks. And like, if I thought the organization would just not play him or give Obi his due, then yeah, like fine, bring Randle off the bench and go that route. But I would give up one non-Knicks first round pick to get off Julius Randle.
Fair. So the flip side of this is, how much would it cost to get RJ Barrett from you?
Probably less than you think.
Really?
I said during the Jazz negotiations that if they wanted RJ and that was going to save you future first round picks, you give up RJ. And so that's where I'm at. I don't know what, if I'm the Knicks, I'm looking for in exchange for RJ Barrett. But like, if an offer comes along, I don't know how other teams would view him, to be honest. And like, let's throw the contract out of the equation, because he's poison pilled right now, so it's a little bit tougher to move. In a vacuum this offseason, if some team comes calling and is like, well, I'll give you the number, I don't know, 12 pick for RJ Barrett, I might do it.
I realize I had one more Knicks question. do the Knicks have too many lefties?
Yeah, I've actually been asked that question a bunch. I guess, because I don't understand like how you could run your lineups differently to where they're all not playing at once. Like that would be something. But I don't think Brunson seems comfortable enough operating on both sides of the court where it's not like a huge issue. But like, yes, it's overkill having Julius Randle and RJ Barrett and Jalen Brunson in the same start. Like, it's just no. That's why that's another reason to just trade Randle is like, let's lighten up the lefties because we know Tibbs isn't going to stagger nearly enough to do it.
I was watching them and they like drove left, kicked it out, and then drove left again, right back into that same defensive cluster, and then kicked it out and drove left again. And I'm like, normally, you know, you kick it out a couple of times and it's a guy that drives right, and then you kick it to the lefty. He cuts left. And you're like, this is good. We've got difference. We've got some versatility in our offense. And as a lefty, I was like, man, it's not normal that you see this just keep happening again and again. So,
and you might think it would catch teams off guard, but I think it just makes the Knicks more predictable because most of their lefties are just not eminently comfortable going right.
I wanted to touch on one of the pieces that you've written recently, which is grading the best players under 25. And there were a lot of really good ones in there. You know, it's nice because you went team by team. So it wasn't just the best players under 25, it was each team's. So I got to see what you thought of Lonnie Walker and BJ Boston, the LA guys out there. But I was wondering, you posted that on the 13th. Is there anyone under 25 that's really jumped out or just completely nosedived since?
Jumped out even more from that list. I mean, Jason Tatum is probably one. His passing has just gotten clearly absurd. But he's like sort of a known name. Michael Porter Jr., like all of a sudden he was dealing with the heel injury, but he all of a sudden couldn't hit a bucket from three after shooting like a trillion percent. So that's definitely stood out. I think Tyrese Haliburton has impressed me even more. Like, I think I gave him an A at the time, and I'd probably give him an even higher grade at this point. I was surprised at how well Lonnie Walker was playing at the time and sort of still am. I'm trying to think if there's anyone on that list that I would have underrated or was too high on. Zion's been a lot better since then. I think they put the ball in his hands more, and he's been better defensively away from the ball, so that's helped. I gave Shane A+, so it can't be him. I think you look at a team that actually might just be worth, I couldn't write about all their players, but like Wendell Carter Jr. has gotten better. And Franz Wagner, like that's just a team that, and Jalen Suggs even, that's a team that's just stocked with under 25 guys that are really good. And a player who you don't even think about in that context. And he's only 23, like Bol Bol's just been out of his absolute mind this year. He's clearly not the Magic's best player under 25, but he's like, there's like real feel for the game there. He's operating like a wing on offense. He finishes these wild layups from like a trillion feet out, but they're still layups. So I think if we're looking for a guy who wasn't on that list that I think has blown me away since, it's probably pretty easily Bol Bol.
Yeah, the Magic have just been so much fun to watch this year with the crazy lineups they can put out there. I mean, they put out lineups of Bol, Wendell, Paolo, Franz Wagner, and occasionally they'll even throw like a Terrence Ross in there where, I mean, Wagner and Paolo are being their point guards or Bol is being the point guard in a particular set. It's like the anti-Knicks. You've got a bunch of players just going out there and doing whatever, and it's working. Well, as much as you want it to.
You're experimenting. So like even when it doesn't look good and the offense can be a slog for those points, especially while you're dealing with like the absence of Paolo Banchero, you're trying it. Like more power to them. That's what they should be doing at this stage. They're a fun kind of not good is the best way to describe them.
Exactly. Something that will get fans excited, but will still give you a good chance at Wembanyama or Scoot Henderson, which for them might be an even better option.
Yeah, they really need better guard play. I mean, we know Fultz isn't healthy, ditto for Cole Anthony, but they're also not the answer. And I think it puts you in a situation that when Jalen Suggs is healthy, he's overstretched because you're trying to use him as his point guard. And I just don't think that's his game. And I think once we see him play next to a real game manager that doesn't have limitations on his game, like Cole Anthony's just not the best passer. Markel Fultz, I know he hits mid-range jumpers, but he's not like actively looking for those shots. Like teams are giving it to him, so he takes them. And it's just very sort of like a slow process. And it's good that he hits those wide open mid-range jumpers, but like they're not a strength. And until you have like, it's going to mess with your spacing is my point. And so I think once Suggs plays next to a better game manager, maybe that turns out to be Paolo Banchero long-term. That's when we'll see Suggs be optimized and probably the best version of himself.
Yeah. I'll drop a link to the article in the podcast, though. Everyone can go check this out. I really enjoyed the piece. You've got a lot of good writings out there. You've been ranking MVP candidates. I do want to close with one question that we try to ask a lot of our guests, which is dodgeball. If you could build a five-man dodgeball roster out of Knicks from the last decade, who are you choosing?
Oh, man. Out of the last decade? Oh, my God. This is an incredibly tough question.
I was hoping that you could have some players that you actually liked, because, you know, who knows with these last couple of years, are these players that you like or dislike? So had to stretch it out a bit for you.
I'm going to go with Frank Ntilikina would definitely be on my team, because I will die for Frank Ntilikina. I think he's a really good NBA player just hiding in plain sight. And he's feels like he would dive in front of the ball for you and take it. So like, I'll go with Melo. He feels like he'd be really good at dodgeball. I'm almost wondering if like Jalen Brunson can really sling it with passes. I'm wondering if he needs to be on that too. It's just so recent. So it's like, do we have him there? So let's just throw Jalen Brunson, Melo. I said Frank Ntilikina already. He just has to be on that team. So I need to, would you say five guys?
Five. Ntilikina is a great choice, because also if you catch a dodgeball, it gets the other player out. And I feel like Ntilikina is going to have some great hands, you know? Ooh, he's got the defensive, the quick IQ. So
not when he's dribbling, unfortunately, but yeah, hopefully when it's just like involved with catching the ball, that shouldn't be a problem.
You don't have to dribble in dodgeball.
Yeah. So that's a benefit for him, man. I don't know. This is a hard question. I feel like I don't even know if I want Melo on my team anymore. I just have him in there because yeah. Wow. This is tough. I'm also just not in love with a lot of the Knicks I've seen over the past decade is also the problem here.
It's tricky because you want a point guard, someone that's going to be able to pass the ball accurate, whip it, hit at someone with a good speed. But the Knicks, that's kind of been your Achilles heel for a while.
Yeah, if they had better point guards over the last, like, does Jeremy Lin need to be on this team? So like maybe Tyson Chandler feels like he'd be really good at dodgeball. So that could be a good one. That's not more than a decade at this point, is it?
I don't think so.
I think it's just on the fringes there.
But he is a large body. I mean, these are NBA players. They're all large bodies, but I'm just saying, presents a big target.
That's a good point, too. He's skinny, though. So he's like rail thin. So if it's prime,
just if it's turn like, sideways.
Yeah. Also, maybe J.R. Smith, like do just some chaos in dodgeball. Like that might be the move. Yeah, I'm going to do that. I'm going to throw J.R. Smith on my team just because I feel like I need a little bit of chaos. And am I just going to settle on Tyson Chandler? He's just so smart. I thought about him or maybe like Marcus Camby. Raymond Felton might be pretty good at. No, you know what? Pablo Prigioni. That's the one. I need Prigioni, Ntilikina. We'll go Melo, J.R. Smith for chaos. And I'm going to throw Jalen Brunson on there. So it's like very guard heavy here, but I feel like that's a good dodgeball team. It took me a while to get there, but I'm not working with much over the last decade for the Knicks.
Good. Well, thank you so much for coming on. Dan, can you plug all of your pluggables? We want to make sure that all the people know where to find you, who will read your stuff, hear your podcasts, check out your tweets.
Yeah, so they can follow me on Twitter. I post all my content from Bleacher Report, where I cover the NBA full-time, on there, at Dan Favale, F-A-V-A-L-E. And check out the Hardwood Knocks podcast. We are, in my totally unbiased opinion, one of the most underrated league-wide podcasts out there. We are seriously unserious. We are wherever you get your podcasts, Apple, Spotify, YouTube, Stitcher, Google, the whole nine. And we're at Hardwood Knocks on Twitter and TikTok, and at Hardwood_Knocks on Instagram. So go check us out. Give us a listen if you've never heard of us before.
Well, thanks for having me on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a blast.